Yesterday, we brought you the story of the Cyclops baby, a child born really badly disfigured, doomed to die. The doctor told the baby's mother, in an attempt to spare her the trauma of seeing her child, that it had died at birth. And then the hospital staff stood by for 13 days as the severely disabled and disfigured child, who was unable to eat because of a birth defect, starved to death, and there was nothing they could do. Dr. Frederick Newman recalled this event in a blog post for Psychology Today, and he told us the story here on this show yesterday.
What I was trying to indicate in this blog is that there are experiences that are so peculiar in their character, so distinctive, so unexpected, that the usual rules break down, and that people are finally left with the idea, what is the right thing to do in this situation?
That is the question we often ask. Art Kaplan, the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, joining us now by phone from Philadelphia. So, Art, are we still asking this question? I mean, this baby died in 1960. What have we changed in terms of our policies in hospitals since then?
Hi, Celeste. Well, we have changed because a lot of babies were allowed to die at that time, even ones with conditions like Down syndrome or spina bifida. If they had something else wrong and the parents said, don't fix it, the babies were allowed to die. So it led to quite a controversy in the 1980s with people legislating, passing laws called the baby doe laws, sort of an anonymous baby doe, saying you had to treat infants. Today, the presumption is you will treat, even when parents say no, unless the baby is kind of like the Cyclops baby, irreversibly dying. So we have much more aggressive policies and much more aggressive treatment given to kids with both mild but also severe congenital or born with defects.
But what about this idea that with a baby, as in the case of this baby, who they could not save this child? It was, in fact, doomed to die and yeah, would still be so today. What about the decision to tell the parents or not the parents? Has that question been settled?
Well, it's shifted a good deal from the 60s. Today, you're going to get, I would say, 99.9% of the time, an honest discussion with the parents that this child has been born with a fatal birth defect, say, a good part of its brain missing, a terrible condition known as anencephaly. Parents then are going to be given a choice. You could take the child home and let it die there and get some support and care for it. You probably could give support care, just trying to give pain control as the baby dies, palliative care, which wasn't always done, to be honest. Even the Cyclops baby probably didn't get a lot of morphine back in the day. Or you might say, be aggressive, try to prolong the life of this child, even though we can't stop dying. But you could lengthen its life for days or weeks, and some parents do choose that. So you get a lot more options presented and a range of responses to the dying baby today.
One of the options, though, of course, is that perhaps now we would have a better idea before birth of this child's health condition, right?
That's right. So back in the day there with Cyclops baby, the arguments were kind of how to manage a birth defect, and the bias was against it and allowing to die. What we're starting to see now is shifting in testing to permit knowing what the baby's problems might be when it's still inside the mom. Prenatal testing, and we're getting better and better at that. A lot of listeners are familiar with amniocentesis, where you have to use a big needle to try and get fluid out of the amniotic sac in the mother. It's a risky thing. We don't do it that much unless the mom's at high risk of a problem. But we're starting to be able to look at DNA from the mom's bloodstream. Just getting a blood sample, you can start to find fetal DNA. The future debate is not going to be about whether the baby should die, but whether the baby should be born.
But we're speaking with Art Kaplan, who's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. But Art, really what's at heart here, and this is something that many of our listeners have spoken about, is the treatment, even in 1960, of a human being, a disabled, even disfigured child. I want to read you this comment from Judith in Larchmont, New York. She wrote this at thetakeaway.org. I'm a board-certified genetic counselor who began my training in the 70s. Over the years, I saw babies much like this one born and expire within a relatively short time after birth. These babies are given sedation so they're not hungry and crying. Their parents are encouraged to hold and visit the baby, even sometimes take the child home, as you said. It's important for the parents because often the actual contact with their baby removes the fear that the child is a monster and the reality is not nearly as bad as what they imagine. We've come a long way from the scenario Dr. Newman experienced. Your response?
Come some way, not a long way. You know, disability, severe deformity in a child still frightens us. I constantly am amazed to see that a lot of the appearance of severely deformed children has worked its way into our kind of horror stories and literature. And what I mean is, some kids look like little vampires. Some kids look like little wolfmen. Cyclops Baby obviously has a forerunner in Greek mythology. We don't quite know all the time what to do with the deformed and severely damaged infant. Are they human? Do they have a soul? Are they a person? Should we relate to them? Obviously, I think the answers to that question should be yes, but it's been difficult over humanity's sort of lifespan to kind of wrestle with those questions. And oftentimes, the things that we see that are considered our monsters do come from the world of biology gone wrong.
But I wonder, Art, about this idea that having physical contact with your child, even if it's badly disformed and disfigured, might help you to let go or help the grieving process and might help the dying of this infant.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it does help the parents. I think it may help them separate. In some cases, however, it forms a bond where they start to build unrealistic expectations. You told me my baby can't live. It's 2 weeks. The baby's still here. Let's do everything we can to keep the baby going. The doctor may be thinking, but that isn't good for the baby. That isn't going to produce an outcome where we have a child that makes it past a few more weeks. Maybe it's time to sort of cut back and not be aggressive. So you can build a bond, but you can also build a situation where the parents can't let go.
Well, this is clearly a conversation that continues today. And Art, at some point, it's going to be something that you think will become an established policy? We'll have a right and a wrong?
I don't think so. I think what we're going to say is this. The parents have the discretion to do what they want, but we all need to be thinking hard about disability, not the disability incompatible with life, but what we really think of as constituting a disability, because that's where the testing is taking us. We're not done with this issue yet. It's just shifting, if you will, earlier and earlier.
Art Kaplan, head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center, speaking to us from Philadelphia. Thanks so much, Art.
Thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.